podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. This episode is brought to you by Charles Tirrett, who it's safe to say are big cricket fans. They've got Josh Butler as their ambassador and they also kit out Middlesex and Durham as their official menswear partners. We've got a special code for our listeners throughout the month of June. You get 20% off at Charles Tirrett using the code WISDENPOD online or quoting in store. We've got loads to get through on this show. We'll talk a little bit about the England-New Zealand series. We've got an interview with Matt Parkinson where we hear all about his manic test debut. We'll talk about the ODI World Cup Super League, Mitali Raj's retirement. We've got a chat with Charlie Dean ahead of the Charlotte Edwards Cup final, and there's much more as well. To get through that with me today is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and freelance cricket wordsmith, Jim Wallace. Jim, good to have you back with us. On the Trent Bridge test, England have announced their side for the second test. It is unchanged, with Jack Leach having made a recovery from his concussion he suffered on the opening day at Lord's, meaning that Matt Parkinson, his concussion replacement, misses out. I spoke to Parkinson a couple of days ago about his crazy debut, where he became England's first ever concussion substitute. Here is that chat. Matt Parkinson, England test cricketer, how does that sound?
It sounds a bit strange. Probably not really sunk in just yet. Obviously, this week's been a bit of a whirlwind. I was getting ready to have a nice Jubilee Thursday off. Was then going to play against Northants on Friday night and pretty much not resign myself to the fact that I probably won't play for England for a while. But it wasn't really on my radar, as I've said this week. It was very random and I'm just very pleased that it went fairly well. Looking forward to this week now.
So what communication did you have with anyone from England before Thursday? So you were told that you were a concussion reserve?
Yeah, I was told I was a concussion reserve, but that was about 3 weeks ago. So when you're a concussion reserve, the chances are it's not going to happen, is it? Like, it's very, very random, very rare that would happen. And then I got a phone call from GZ, must be 3.5 weeks ago now, maybe 4 weeks ago, saying, not made the squad. You're a concussion replacement for Jack, and that I wasn't in the Holland squad as well. So yeah, to get that phone call wasn't a great phone call, obviously, but I was pretty happy playing for Lancashire. Good start to the season, and I'm loving my cricket for them this year. So when I saw Jack go down as badly as he did, I sort of had a half thought that I might get a call, but again, I wasn't sure whether they'd made a couple of other boys concussion subs, you know, Bessie, Mo, I don't know what conversations he'd had with him and stuff, so I wasn't fully sure that I wasn't going to get a call. But then I got a phone call at about 12 o'clock saying, can you come to Lords? So yeah, very fast sort of change up.
Yeah, it was crazy quick. I mean, you had a T20 game against Derbyshire on what, Wednesday?
Wednesday afternoon, and then we had Thursday off, and then we were playing on Friday against Northants.
I read that you were having like people over at yours for a barbecue when you found out.
Yeah, that got a bit exaggerated, but I was planning to have a barbecue on the Sunday. I was actually going to the Lake District on Thursday. The car was packed, ready to go. I think I made a comment by Lord. I was meant to be having a lads round for a barbecue, and then it sort of the story just grew from there, really. But yeah, I had a nice weekend planned. But no, obviously, 3 days that I had there was fantastic. As I said, it probably hasn't properly sunk in, because 4 days ago I had this conversation, I had a laugh, so yeah. To now be a test cricketer and to have a test wicket into my name is brilliant.
So how did you find out? So did you get a phone call saying get down to London ASAP?
Yeah, so I was watching the game. Carl was getting packed to go away for the night, and got a phone call from the team manager saying, can you come down to London? At that stage, I thought it would just be a kit, and within a couple of hours, I had my flight pod on ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, what was the drive down like? Because I was on loads of like cricket, tragic WhatsApp groups, and people knew that you were making the drive down before you'd reached Lords. Like, the news was already confirmed that Matt Parkinson is going to be Jack Leach's concussion substitute. So, like, did you stop off at a service station? Were there people coming up to you being like, good luck?
No, not really. I don't know how one of the journals found out where I had exactly stopped as well. I don't know who leaked that to him. It's very random. I stopped at Kiel Services, got some food and coffee, and I sort of knew they were like, when I left home, they were like 6 down, already 7 down, so I was like, probably not going to have to bowl on field by the time I get there. So I probably only got there at about 5 to the hotel. And then I went straight from the hotel to the ground. And yeah, as I said, within an hour, I had my flight on.
This might be a stupid question, but did you have all your kit?
No, I had to go to Old Trafford and pick up my kit. I had to get my white pads out of my garage. Because obviously we haven't played red ball now for 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, so... I've just been carrying around a bat and gloves. I don't even bother taking a helmet and pads to T20 sometimes. So, I had to go to Old Trafford, get my kit, and then I contemplated having a little bowl with Wanks's spin coach, Carl Crook, when in the hostel. When I got to the ground, but we sort of thought it was best just to sort of set off and sort of get to the ground. It's one of those, like, where is he? I'm like, it's only so fast you can drive without breaking the land speed records and getting every speeding ticket that I've done. So I just tried to drive steady away and not rush, and luckily there was no traffic. So yeah, I got to the hotel at about 10 to 5, went to my room, and then literally went in my shorts and t-shirt to the ground, and I was in the changing room.
What were you thinking on the drive down? Because that is quite a long drive to just be contemplating, shit, I'm playing test cricket in possibly an hour and a half.
Yeah, pretty much that, as you say. Bit of nerves, bit of excitement. Trying not all to think it. Like, I was thinking I've not bowled a red ball for 2.5 weeks, shit. Like, forgotten how to do it type of thing. But, no, I just tried to chill out and relax, and there's nothing you can do in a car, so there's no point worrying too much about what's going on. I actually thought at one stage I was going to go there and just bat twice and not bowl, so when I saw they were 100 for 9 and then we got bowled out for 140, I was sort of resigning myself to the fact that I wouldn't get a bowl. But no, yeah, as you say, it was a tough drive down. Like, as you say, it's a long drive and your emotions and thoughts can sort of run wild, but I like to think that I turned up in a decent headspace.
And what was it like linking up with the dressing room? Had you met Brendan McCullum before?
I'd never met Baz before. Obviously, all the other boys I'd been on loads of tours with and stuff, so it was pretty easy. It's been pretty well documented. I've spent a lot of time in that changing room, so they're a fantastic set. They were really happy for me that I'd finally got a game. And, luckily we started with a win as well.
What was it like when you got there? Because if you're arriving around about half five, that was basically when the wicket started falling on the first day. So what was the mood like in the dressing room like the moment you arrived?
That was good. Very, very, very positive. I don't think there's probably any other word you can describe the dressing room than positive with Baz and Stokesy. In charge, because everyone was relaxed and made me feel very welcome. For what was happening in the first day, it was very relaxed. I mean, if that was probably county cricket, we'd have been panicking and lads have been throwing pads around and shitting themselves. But no, it was very relaxed, and I think that sort of filtered through into the bowling as well, and my bowling as well, that I knew that I had the backing of the changing room. I knew that lads were genuinely happy that I was playing, and even Leach, he's one of my best mates, he was buzzing for me. Not obviously a great way to make your test debut, be the concussion replacement for one of your closest mates who takes a knock on the head, but he was brilliant with me the whole week, and as were all the boys.
That's awesome. Before we get to your bowling, got to ask you Talk me through the on drive.
Yeah, that's the only reason I accepted this call. Talk about my on drive. Yeah, it was nice, that wasn't it? I enjoyed that. Yeah, it was fun, but it was nice to bat with Jimmy as well. Kept it pretty relaxed. Yeah, it was fun, I enjoyed it. It was nice to start with the bat actually as well and not go straight into bowling. It was nice to sort of get a feel for the crowd, the ground, sort of what Test cricket is about, because when you're on the bench for a long time, you can probably take it for granted.
Mm.
You just think, oh, another day of carrying drinks, and you probably don't take in the atmosphere or the size of the crowd, because there's no pressure on you to carry a drink. You just run it out, and someone needs gloves, you run a glove out, you do a bit of running and lunch and stuff. But that was nice to start with the bat with Jimmy, and yeah, and I was pretty pleased that I managed to get a decent bowl on day two. Obviously, would have liked us to bat till halfway through day four and then have a bowl, but no, as weeks go, I think it went as well as it could.
Had you bowled much in first class cricket at Lords before?
Once properly in the Bob Willis Trophy final last year, I bowled about 35 overs from the nursery end, which is the end I enjoyed more in the game as well. Never really bowled much from the pavilion end.
And you started from the pavilion end, right?
Yeah, I bowled about, let's say, 10 overs from the pavilion end. So yeah, it was a new experience, and I've never really played at Lords that early in the season as well. Like, my only real bowl at Lords was, I did one on my debut season where I might bowl 20 odd overs, but I'm not really counting that because I was 19.
Hmm.
I can't remember how I bowled, but yeah, the Bob Willis Trophy, we bowled on day one and two and three. We just fielded all day, the whole game. But that was nice. I thought it came out okay. Obviously, would have liked to bowl all better, but the preparation and the build-up and everything that went with it, if you'd have offered me one for 47 off 15 and a half, I'd have probably taken it.
Yeah, I mean, what was it like bowling in a Lords Test match? As you say, it's not in early June. Lords isn't exactly a spinner's paradise, and you managed to keep the runs under control and create a few chances as well.
Yeah, I thought it went okay. First couple of overs were a bit nervy, but now bowling to two set players on, as you say, early June Lords pitch is quite difficult, and they did put me under pressure. I think they ran at 27% of the balls in my first spell. So yeah, to come out of it going at just over threes, I was pretty pleased with. Got nice feedback from the lads. Jimmy spoke nice at the end of the game about me and Popsy. So sort of came off feeling fairly happy, not fully knowing how the people thought. And then to have sort of the feedback that I did a decent job was nice. It sort of rounded off three days, I guess.
From a New Zealand point of view, Colin de Grandhomme has been ruled out of the series through injury. He could be replaced by Henry Nicholls, who might be fit. The spin bowling all-rounder Michael Bracewell, who's yet to play Test cricket, could come in. He or a quick could also come in for Ajaz Patel, who only bowled two overs at Lords. Jim, what's your moment of the week that's loosely related to New Zealand?
Well, yeah, it is loosely. So I initially said it was going to be Joe Root's ton, but you said, you know, everyone sees Joe Root get tons, and I guess they do these days. So my moment of the week is after the game, I spent a bit of time in the bar across the road from Lords with Jeremy Coney, who those in the know will know is, you know, one of the preeminent cricket broadcasters and captain of New Zealand back in the 80s when they were a fairly ragtag bunch. And
qualifies as pod favourite, I think.
Pod favourite?
I think we've mentioned him a few times before.
It's been a while since our last Coney mentioned.
And I have to say, I've not been doing this gig very long, but he was probably my favourite ever interview, just because he was so erudite and had lots of funny side stories and anecdotes and just a real cricket brain. You know, we talked about the Test match because that had finished a few hours earlier, and he had some quite strong opinions on Test cricket, batsmanship.
What did he say?
He said, interestingly, he didn't enjoy the Test.
Really?
Really.
I thought it was really entertaining.
Well, I sort of felt very sad after day one. I thought, you know, that it was all going to be over in 2 days, and, you know, it's a Lord's test, the first test of the summer, and this sort of showpiece event that... I think his point was that they kept on handing the advantage back to each other, which does make for a sort of thrilling test match, but felt a little bit like luck. And, you know, the sort of standard. The bowling obviously was fantastic, yeah. But if you take out that partnership by Blundell and Mitchell on the second day, and then Root, obviously, then it could have just all been done in. It could have been a one-day test match. Maybe we're not too far from that. But, yeah, we spoke about all sorts of things, about the amateur nature of New Zealand back when they came over to England in 1986, and they won for the first time. Richard Hadley getting 19 wickets, and they had to fly economy class, didn't have any shirt sponsors, and they were coming up against, you know, relative superstars, yeah, in Gower and Gatting, and both of them came back for the Oval Test.
He really is one of the great commentators, isn't he?
Yeah.
You've got to be careful, though, saying that he's your favourite person you've interviewed, because actually Chris Gayle listens to this show.
Oh, does he?
You've obviously
interviewed. Oh, yeah. No, he was not my favourite interview, but an interesting interview, I suppose. But yeah, maybe it was because I did Coney straight after... Old Chris.
Quite a contrast, yeah.
Yeah, there was a bit of a contrast. But he was very, you could see that, because obviously he's a nice guy and he's got a fairly sing-song voice and that's all part of his charm, but you could see as a captain you would play for him. I was thinking that almost immediately. I was thinking this guy would get the best out of me. Maybe that he just sort of spoke to my personality, but he was saying you play hard, really hard. He doesn't really like this thing about New Zealanders being nice or nicey-nicey all the time, but he was like saying, you know, you play hard and then you deserve your fun off the pitch. So they had a lot of fun off the pitch as well, but, you know, mightily successful. Beat Australia home and away, drew with the West Indies. So, yeah, it was a...
And that interview's in the next Wisden Cricket Monthly.
Yeah, I've not given too much away about it, but it's in the next issue
You've
of
given
the
away less than Phil normally does when he talks about
that's
his interviews.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. Did he have any thoughts on how good this New Zealand side is compared to that one? Does he think this is just the best ever and there's no contest? Because that side was a brilliant team. And, you know, yeah, obviously you had West Indies being so dominant, but you had a very strong undercurrent of teams then, and New Zealand were one of those. I mean, this New Zealand team hasn't won in Australia, for example. Did he talk about that, or is that not?
He did. He spoke about how, I think there's a real pride that he has in that side that he captained, in that he really forged them from not very much, and they had some real talent that went on to become, you know, your Crows, your Martin and your Jeff Crow, people like Ewan Chatfield, the sort of unsung heroes. There was that famous comment by, I think it was Gooch, who said playing against New Zealand is like playing against the World 11 from one end, which is Richard Hadley, and the Ilford second 11 from the other, which is the rest of their bowling attack. And then after they beat them, I think Coney said it was Hadley got Ilford second 11 shirts made up, and they all had photos in their Ilford second 11 shirts after the game. So he was very proud of... He told me some great stories about how, you know, they weren't cosseted cricketers from England getting trained by ex-pros in the indoor nets at Lord's or the Oval. You know, Ewan Chatfield learnt to bowl with an apple in an orchard. These are guys who run 20 kilometres to school. Like, really stuff that we, you know, is obviously really funny and chucklesome now to think about it. But, you know, John Bracewell was a grave digger. Again, I'm giving more away from the actual interview now, but definitely still by the mag. But, you know, they came from a pretty much a different world from what we know, and they pulled off some big scalps.
Well, from Ilford second 11 to the T20 blast, we're over halfway through the group stage. Surrey and Lancashire are both still unbeaten. Ben, your moment of the week is from the blast.
Yeah, well, it's from the Roses derby last night, and as I was watching it, I was thinking, like, maybe this is the solution to all of cricket's ills. You get rid of the 100, you get rid of the rest of the T20 blast, get rid of Test cricket, just have all cricket be Yorkshire v Lancashire, alternating between Headingley and Old Trafford, because it is inevitably the best game in the cricketing calendar, right? Like, it's a rivalry which both teams really care about, always very high quality, always incredible finishes. I mean, the first game of the season, you had that tie where Harry Brook batted like a dream and then missed a straight one last ball of the innings. This game, it was kind of, the ending was both sides, like everyone basically in the ground, like, just trying not to bottle it and basically failing. Danny Lamb, who's, you know, is a very creditable seamer, but was clearly struggling a bit under the pressure of the last over, was sort of bowling a big wides, putting out of his run-up, that sort of thing. Dominic Drake's there.
I think he was doing that to ramp up the, you know how they sort of do it to to put the pressure back on the batsman by almost pulling out and getting in their head a bit? Or was he just really nervous?
It was an incredible act of hoodwinkery, I think.
Because he was just really nervous.
He was probably hoodwinking himself as well,
Even at the very, very end, it wasn't clear who the winner is.
Well, so in terms of who was bottling it, yeah, Dominic Drakes, who was 4 of 7 going into that last ball when they needed 4 to tie, 6 to win. And he then, you know, slices out to the fielder on the rope. The cameraman also then loses the ball, goes, pans to the crowd. So you think it's gone into the crowd, and the crowd also kind of celebrating. You say like, okay, Yorkshire have done this. And then there was a clip later going around, which showed also that Matt Revis, who was at the other end, had also kind of lost track of himself, but the situation was running, celebrating after the shot had been hit. And Drake's come points like, what are you celebrating for? I've been caught, basically.
It was an amazing catch from Tom Hart in the boundary. It was really good. Really good catch in the boundary.
And just an incredible game across the board. I mean, Tom Cuddock-Cadmore wasn't supposed to be playing in it. I mean, they made a slightly odd squad change late on, which I'm not clear why, but Harry Brooke was pulled out, Finn Allen was pulled out, and Milan and Cuddock-Cadmore came in, which is two decent players to bring in. And Cuddock-Cadmore hit, what, 70 or 40 odd in a chase of 214. Willie made a very good half century. Tim David was the star for Lancashire. He was, I think, he was 6 off 11 balls, and then ended up 66 off 32, which is crazy. And this, what
his
he does,
rise is extraordinary. I mean, I saw him play in the 2019 T20 World Cup qualifier for Singapore, and I had to double check to make sure I wasn't misremembering this. He just didn't have that good a tournament. Mm. Fast forward 2.5 years, he's one of the most sought after T20 players in the world, and he just seems to do it everywhere. And he just, his game is pretty simple, right? He's big, strong, and just hits it hard. And
has he come from no? Is he sort of like a Happy Gilmore figure who's sort of a right? Because he's not that young, right? Is he sort of?
He's not that. So he's 26, I think.
Yeah.
In the last year, it's been a meteoric rise, right? So he was playing Royal London One Day Cup for Surrey, bossed it in the PSL, bossed it in the IPL after initially being overlooked, and now the Blast isn't the pinnacle of all those things, but he's just smashed it wherever he's gone.
And his record in T20 cricket is just phenomenal. He averages 35, which is good, like no qualification, and strikes 165, which is absurd. That's from more than 100 games. So I think the question will be kind of what next from an international point of view. I mean, he is now going, I mean, he is basically the informed T20 batter in the world. He like will be sought after wherever he goes, and he is eligible to play for Australia. It would seem mad to me if they don't try and get him in to the T20 World Cup squad. I think it's a similar situation, I think Ben Jones put that switch, it's like the Arch situation for England in 2019, where sure, there might be some established players who have no power or joint by having been part of the group leading up to tournament or whatever, and sure, Australia won it last time and have built a team that works, but this guy is just so good, you just can't ignore him, I think. And I think that should happen, I think. And then, you know, you wonder where the limit is for him. I mean, it's not as if he's a 1 in every 3 games coming off type of player. He is doing it consistently. And then you wonder, can that be translated to the 50 over format possibly? And you've got another World Cup next year. I mean, it's going to be a massive and very interesting 12, 18 months for Tim David.
Mm, absolutely. So Lancs, Birmingham, Northampton, Yorkshire are currently in the top four in the North group. Surrey, Somerset, Essex and Gloucestershire in the top four in the South. There was a double tactical retirement in the rain-affected game between Birmingham and Notts. Carlos Brathwaite retired himself with an over to go for Birmingham when he saw that the leg spin of Calvin Harrison was being brought on. Brathwaite has a poor recent record against leg spin. And then Sam Patel was retired out with one ball to go in the run chase, with Notts needing 3 off the last ball. Sam Patel was at the non-striker's end, and Harrison, the quicker runner, was brought on for what was essentially just running. We talked about this a little bit when this happened in the IPL a couple of months ago, when Ravi Chandran and Ashwin did something similar. But two in the same game, I think, is unprecedented. Jim, do you have an opinion on tactical retirements? And if not, can you please confect one?
Yeah, I'll come up with one on the spot. Well, neither of them worked, right? Neither of the retirements worked. So the guy that came in for Patel only got one run, and Brathwaite's replacement didn't
face a ball.
Yeah. It didn't not work.
Well, by my standard, they neither worked. I mean,
and sorry, what was odd on the Harrison thing is they then didn't kind of keep running as long as they possibly could.
No.
Like they basically did that thing where you run and then go like, no, send him back when, like, you know, there could be a fumble, that sort of thing, which is especially odd when you've gone to all the effort. But yeah.
Yeah. I guess, so Jonathan Liu wrote something in The Guardian this week about it, and I tend to agree with what he said. He sort of sat on the fence a little bit, but he basically said that there's something elemental about cricket in the struggle of somewhat a batter at the crease. And I guess the whole thing with the retirement is that the fielding side have done well to get on top of the batsman. It feels a bit, or the batter, it feels a bit harsh to them that then they're just allowed to sort of sub someone in, sub someone out. I mean, that's the struggle of cricket, really. So I don't have a strong opinion either way. I guess they're trying to push the envelope, aren't they? They're trying to do these sort of things. It'll be interesting if when, and it will happen, when they do a retirement and it really comes off and it changes a game or wins a game, that'll be...
The one in the IPL did actually work because Parag scored...
8 or 4, yeah, I think, yeah.
And again, they only just won. I instinctively don't like the Samit Patel one.
Mm. I've not seen it, but did he sort of... It feels a bit brutal that if the dugout is sort of saying, we'll get him off because he's not fast, or did he sort of say...
No, I think it came from the dugout.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, part of... One of the many reasons why I enjoy cricket is you have people who are not very good at something just like having to do it.
Yeah.
Like tail end of
the whole night watchman. Yeah, yeah.
Even yesterday, we were at the Oval watching Surrey versus Sussex. Sunil Narine is going at less than 5 and over in the T20 Blast at the moment. And watching him bowl against batters who just haven't faced mystery spin like that is entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
But I do like it as a tactical development. But I think there needs to be a punishment for the batting side. They can't. It's effectively a substitution at the moment. Mm. That happens late in innings and there isn't any consequence for you making that decision.
Mm.
Really, when that's happened so far, I'd like to see a consequence. So basically sacrificing a ball. So it is a dot ball when you retire someone out. I think I'd like to see that.
Yeah. I think my feeling is, though, is that I find it interesting and I like thinking when watching a game, oh, could they retire someone? Is there a profitable matchup in the dugout that could happen? And I think that is an interesting thing, and having things that are interesting in a sport is good. And then it's not like where at the moment there aren't loads of them, and I don't think we are headed for a situation where there's something that is happening every game. I think it will remain quite a rare thing. And so if you add something else that discourages it, you will basically end up just killing it altogether, I think, which, well, I mean, I find it hard to get worked up about it in the way that some people
do. Go on, get
do.
Worked up.
I'm surprised. You're normally the person who gets worked up by the things that no one else in the world has yet realised.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one of those things where, like, I mean, there's definitely no ethical concern or spirit of cricket thing or whatever in this situation. And it just depends, you know, it's a very small tweak around what you want cricket to be and to look like. And I think you can look at T20 cricket in two ways. You can look at it as that elemental thing of batter versus bowler, and you don't want that to be diluted. And in that instance, you would want to remove retired outs from it. Or you can look at it as this kind of almost like this question of like, how can teams best maximize their resources in terms of balls and wickets remaining? And this is another thing that allows them to do that. And I suppose the cost in terms of retiring a batter towards the end, the cost is actually felt earlier on, if that makes sense. Like, it's you allow yourself to do that by preserving wickets earlier on. Like, if you're 7 down going into the last over, you're unlikely to retire somewhere. So if you're 4 down or 3 down, that's what gives you the opportunity to, but that comes with a cost earlier on, or it should do. So I guess that would be so it's different ways to maximize the runs you can score with what you have available to you. And that's what I find most about T20 cricket, is teams finding every possible way to do that. And that's why I am broadly in favor of them. But I guess
with these things, it's like where it's at this stage now, where will it then become, you know, take someone like the aforementioned Chris Gayle. Would this sort of thing extend his career by years and years, because he's just allowed to be a sort of substitute figure who doesn't have to do a lot? They have to field, obviously, and play the rest of the game or whatever. But
I can't remember who it was. Somebody made the point when we talked about this last time that this is actually going to happen pretty rarely. There are fairly few matching situations where it is worth sacrificing a batter to have someone on the bench
who you picked in the first 11.
I think it's one of those where you might see it more at the death, but I think other than that, not
particular,
not really.
Skills as well. So this is a weird sort of reference, but Callum Giles used to play hockey for England in the 90s, I think, at the Atlanta Olympics, and he used to be a penalty corner specialist. So he didn't really play the games. Obviously, they just had a rule where you had rolling subs, but he was amazing at penalty corners, sort of either taking them or I think maybe the guy that hits them. And he barely used to play. He just used to come on and ping it in the goal and then trot off again. I'm just thinking about a point where this could get to, where you get these cricketers who are just, you know, amazing at smacking off spinners down the ground for 6, but don't do a lot else.
I think one thing which has basically held through throughout all of T20 cricket is that a batter who is set is almost always preferable to a batter who is not set, basically. That every, like, we were talking about Tim David in the innings last night, and the acceleration was incredible, but he was 6 of 11, so you wouldn't have wanted to retire for him even with 2 or 3 overs to go, knowing if, you know. And that's also something that I think will make it rarer. And then that's added, I think, when you get, you know, if you want to bring someone in for the last ball of the game, say, to hit a 6, there is also absolutely loads of pressure on that player. I mean, you think of, using a hockey example, using football example, like Mark Noble being subbed on for a penalty, or the yeah. Euros final with those players who got subbed on the last minute. I mean, that seems to rarely end well, that kind of thinking. So as I say, I think it will be quite rare, and that's why I'm not hugely fussed about discouraging it as well, I think. I guess, you don't want the last over drama is good, but you don't want it to be drawn out. And having, like, especially if you get a situation where you've got loads of wickets in hand, you want the fast person, the non-striker's end at all times. So you're retiring someone out to get a fast non-striker on, then they manage to run a single, but that person is a tail ender, so then you're retiring them out to bring in a hard hitter. So
As I said, I don't think it's actually going to happen that regularly.
But just to flip, you probably want to move on, but just to flip around on you, you're a bowler, you know, if you have tied a batsman down for an over or whatever, that, you know, you've put the effort into doing that. Just from a personal perspective, you'd be livid if...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be absolutely fuming if you... So I'm just thinking about it. It feels a little bit like you're punishing someone for doing something good, which sits a little bit uncomfortably.
Yeah. But I think last time when we talked about tactical retirements in the pod, I think I finished the discussion by saying, hopefully we'll never have to talk about that again. More generally, how have we liked the tournament so far? The game's come so thick and fast. The crowds have been up and down. More empty seats than you'd expect at some games, obviously not taking place during the school holiday. I've felt that, you know, the two teams that are unbeaten, Surrey and Lancashire, they are so good. They are so, so good. Both teams, I think, would do pretty well in the IPL. These players just need to be on TV. Is there anywhere in the world that has cricket this good not being televised? Somerset as well, of fielding sides occasionally where you have 10 players, you have 100 contracts. Why is that in the 100, every game is broadcast? But for the T20 Blast, when you have teams that are either at similar or in some cases maybe even better quality, not being televised. Obviously, the average standard of the Blast is lower than that of the 100, but you do have situations where some teams are just better and much better than the norm. And I think it's odd that they're being hidden on YouTube. I don't have an obvious solution. I'm not saying only broadcast every Lancashire game and nothing else. I'm not saying that. And I don't know how you get around it. But I think my starting point is, it is bad that these players are not on TV.
Is it bad for cricket that this isn't being showcased enough because of the standard?
It's really good cricket. It's really, really good cricket that should be broadcast, and as many people as possible should be able to see it.
I think it is really good cricket, or at least the standard of some of the cricket is really good, but also you do see a variance between certain teams. I mean, that sorry, Sussex game yesterday, there was good cricket played, but it was also pretty close to a blowout, basically. Like, the game was done kind of at the halfway stage, definitely after that Jacks Roy opening stand. But as you say, there is no perfect solution. I think when you see a game like that, when you see the strength of, you were saying that Somerset field 11, where 10 of the 11 players were in the 100, Lancashire's team is phenomenal. Yorkshire field have been so good. You can look at that and think, okay, a way to go is a two-tier T20 Blast where you televise most of the top tier and there's promotion and relegation. But then that will have knock-on effects for those counties who are in the second tier, for whom T20 Blast is such an important thing in the revenue that they get. And if you are then a second-tier team, that is going to be a harder sell to people, I guess. And there's the fact that you don't get the exposure from being on TV as well. I also think that the one thing we always say about the Blast is how hard it is to follow, because, you know, as you say, you've got a different amount of games every night. It clashes with Test cricket. Although there's a block, there's no structure to that block. It's like, you know, there might be one day there's 5 games, another day there's 2 games. You have no way, there's no...
Some days you have a TV game, some days you don't.
Exactly, there's no appointment to view thing where, you know, if I switch on at this time, there's going to be 220 Blast. There would be ways around that, possibly, where you integrate it across a season with other things. But then players wouldn't like that because you're switching formats, and it also makes it a lot harder to get, say, you can get a Pollard and Orion in for the Blast because it's, you know, 4 weeks basically and then you're done. You can't get them in to be if you're playing 1 or 2 games a week because they're not going to stick around for that long. So there is no perfect solution, but I think I would be in I would prefer a two divisional thing, and I think I would. I'm leaning towards thinking that it's just got to be easier to follow, which means a better structure that has the tournaments integrated would be preferable, I think. But it's a really tough one.
I like having. I mean, Sinan Narine has not played. Has he? I'm not sure if he's even played in the Blast before. If he has, it's a very long time ago. Pollard's not played that much Blast cricket. The fact that it's in a short burst, and you've also got the 100 straight afterwards, so you got, you know, they're already earning money for playing the UK. So you're asking.
You can see why it's attractive as a player, because you come over once and then you're here. And you...
Tim David spending, you know, a very good chunk of the summer here. I just think that something has gone wrong that you have cricketers this good who are not on TV. I know it's on YouTube, and Ben, you were saying before we started recording that we shouldn't underestimate how good YouTube is at showing stuff to new people they otherwise wouldn't watch. You're talking about your
My nephews, I mean, you know, they'll kind of consume anything, but actually YouTube is their first port of call rather than sort of channel hopping. And then last summer they went on YouTube, and there was a one of the women's 100 games being live streamed, and they then watched most of that tournament and then went to some of the games live, which is exactly how that should work. But that was because it was being live streamed. If it had been on TV and not on YouTube, that wouldn't have happened. I mean, you need both, I think.
Do they just think TV is like a weird thing in the corner?
And I'm not sure they even, you know, I mean, they wouldn't have Sky, I don't think.
No.
Whereas stuff, and YouTube, you know, there's loads of stuff on there. Like, people do use YouTube in a way that I think we underappreciate, not to get too deep into that, but like, people do use it as just a social media platform, the way we would just log on to Twitter, see what's on Twitter that day. People log on to YouTube, see what new is on YouTube, scroll through videos that way, rather than being sent a YouTube link and clicking on it. And then,
but how deeply would you have to scroll to get to the Surrey stream, for example, if you're just a regular...
Well, there are...
Jeremy Coney's on the Surrey stream, by the way, so should be tapping it up.
There are algorithms where it recommends stuff based on previous stuff you've watched or stuff that you like and that sort of thing. So I guess if you've watched videos about Ewan Chatfield, then it might show you the Surrey stream or that sort of thing.
Just chock full my history of Ewan Chatfield with his apples in his orchard. What about... The interesting thing is the ground. So they've not been... So we were here last night and it was... I think I saw something that said it was 13,000 people, which is what, half full, if that. Do you think that is to do with the fact that it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday night and people don't necessarily know when the games are, whereas a Friday night here probably would be full because it's a sort of after work crowd? And
a few reasons. Tickets are expensive. You know, it's nearly £40 for it to come in. I mean, membership here is really cheap. Games midweek, lots of games. There are more, with 100, there is more games at the big grounds, and more games in a short period of time as well. So I think there are lots of reasons why.
Well, that's my problem with, not to get again too sort of philosophical, but with short form cricket in general, there's so much of it in and it goes on that it almost renders itself a little bit meaningless. So I wonder if it is a little bit of the games don't stand out from each other, unless it is a Roses match or a Surrey Middlesex, or there's something riding on it. It might just be that they start to all bleed into one.
And even the Roses game yesterday wasn't a sellout as well. And I do think, I mean, 100 tickets are, some of them are cheaper than Blast tickets. And it's for a higher standard of cricket in general. I think the schedule thing, I mean, it's, if you just think from a point of view of a consumer, if there's a game on like a Saturday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday or something, or there's three games in a week, you are going to pick and choose. And especially you'll get some keen cricket fans, but quite a lot of casual fans that go to the Surrey games.
Well, the keen ones will buy memberships.
Yes.
So to get a sellout, you need people to buy for individual games who don't come to that many. So that's the problem, right? There are people who want to watch all of it, but those aren't the people who are going to make you sell out. Pick out a few leading performers so far. Riley Russo is averaging 92 and striking at 192 for Somerset. Durham's Graham Clark is the leading English run scorer. He's at Durham, brother of Jordan. Naveen Al-Haq took 5 for 11 for Leicester the other day. He's having another very good season. David Payne is taking his wickets at 10. Jake Linter is the leading spinner, and Richard Gleeson at Lancashire is going very well for them. Abby Slade asks, your current England men's 11 for the upcoming T20 World Cup brackets based on current form. I'm going to go first. Roy, Butler, Stokes at 3, Bairstow, Brooke, Livingston, Moeen / Sam Curran, depending on conditions. Then Rashid, I mean, we don't know he's going to be fit. Then Archer, Wood and Topley. Mills, listening to the question, based on current form, Mills are going at more than 10 and over in the Blast. Chris Jordan just misses out for me. I can see someone like Richard Gleeson coming into the frame if there are lots of injuries. Yeah, I think that's my lot.
Do Ben, and then I'll try and come up with something controversial.
I couldn't come up with a full 11, partly because I struggled with the frame of the question, because you say on current form, obviously.
Don't slag off the question, Ben.
No. It's a very good and interesting question, but you can just interpret it in a few ways.
Excellently poised.
It's like if on current form, obviously you can't pick Archer because he's, you know, he hasn't played a game of cricket in ages. But if he is fit, he obviously plays, and so that is a tricky one. I mean Milan obviously has been in England's T20 team, has rarely let England down. Also, the conditions should really suit him. He's had an okay blast. He's got a couple of 50s. One of them a really quick one and a sort of 8 over thrash, which shows that he can do that thing as well. And on the flat wickets of those wickets, it doesn't just suit his technique and his skill set, but also suits his approach, I think, where I think you can really make a lot of ground up towards the end of an innings, which is what he is so good at. So I'd be interested to see if he came back into it. I guess also in terms of picking on who England will pick based on form, whatever, it'd be interesting to see what happens with Stokes. I mean, Root's T20I career basically came to an end when he took on the Test captaincy. Will that happen with Stokes? Can he play every game in every format? Clearly not. But will that be sort of a last hurrah for him, especially having missed the last T20 World Cup? Possibly. And then the best at 4 thing is also quite interesting because
he didn't go that well in the IPL, didn't have a good T20 World Cup.
Yeah. But he's clearly such a talented player that England will want to try and find a way to make the most out of him. But that might end up being at number 3, I guess, or even
maybe opening
does
again.
Does he push into an opening spot and Roy misses out, or adapts into a different role? Or you look at, do you have Butler? Because he showed again that slightly different side. He was almost playing Milan-esque cricket at times in the IPL, where he was like, and Raj didn't really want him to do that. That's clearly the role they were asking him to play, whereas he gets to do something slightly different for England with that batting depth that they have. But he could become a very, very effective number 3 because he can do all those things, which I think is what a number 3 especially needs to do. I mean, Bairstow and Roy, be something nice about joining them back up at the top, and then having Butler at 3 to either come in and carry on their work, or to absorb pressure off an early wicket, or to take on the power play if one of them falls early, but the conditions there for that sort of thing. So, I mean, I haven't answered the question at all.
No.
But it's partly because there is a lot of time between now and then. And it's going to be very tough to tell. But the Jordan thing, sorry, can we say one thing on him?
Yeah, you've made a really interesting point before we started recording.
Yeah, which is that he obviously, and he got some stick at the end of the T20 World Cup for his death bowling, which I felt was fair, but he also had a very good tournament with the ball. Aside from that, he's basically just become a different bowler. And I think that he offers so much to the group apart from that. I mean, he is a good batter, especially with the depth England have. He's probably a bit higher, number 7, but a number 8 is a great option to have. And they love him around the group. He's a good mentor to that bowling team. He has seen so much. He's so experienced, and he's a brilliant fielder. That almost, if he's at the team as like a sort of a bowler who fills in the rest of the attack, as in he can, you don't want him as your lead death bowler, but if he has to bowl one over, possibly you can get away with that. And also as an opening bowler and a bowler through the middle, he was really good at taking wickets in that sort of 7 to 12 over period. That could be a role that he actually fills really well. I mean, England have a few more options there, but I can see how Jordan becomes one of the better ones.
Absolutely.
Still looked good last night. It was still rapid.
Yeah, he's had a good blast, yeah.
Matthew asked, does Jake Lintott make the squad? Probably not, because England have typically not picked that many spinners in their squad, but he's had 3 consecutively good blasts. He had a really good 100. He's played in the Caribbean Premier League, the Bangladesh Premier League. I mean,
has he done the Big Bash?
He's no. Not, no. He's got, I think his career economy rate is either just below 7 or about 7. Moving on, Ben, it's been a massive few days for the ODI World Cup Super League. Do you want to fill us in why what the cricket happening at the moment between Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, Pakistan and West Indies is so important?
Yeah, well, it's an odd tournament, the Super League. We talked about it before, but it's probably worth a bit of a recap where so there's 13 teams in it, the full members plus the Netherlands because of their Cricket World Cup League performance in the last cycle. Each of them plays 8 series, 4 at home and 4 away, so each team doesn't play 4 of the other teams. So it's a bit odd from that point of view, but basically the top 7 teams plus India, so basically the top 8 teams will qualify automatically for the World Cup, and the next 5 will go to the Cricket World Cup qualifying event. And the reason why it's interesting is because Bangladesh have basically confirmed qualification. They've won 12 of 18. So that should be enough, and they'll need 1 from the next 6. They've got toughish fixtures, but they should be fine. But more interestingly, Afghanistan are very, very close to securing that qualification as well. They are on track at the moment playing Zimbabwe in the third ODI, World Map 135. So they should be 10 wins from 12, which is, again, very close to being qualified. They've had an easier fixture list, although they've done very well to clean up the games in that. They haven't, you know, we'll get on to some other teams later who haven't managed to do that. But so they have a few more series, and they'll need one or two more wins from those, and then they will be qualified automatically as well, which means that two of the big teams that you would expect to see at every World Cup will be going into that qualifying event. And as we saw from the last tournament, which was, you know, one of the best cricket tournaments has ever been, basically, there are no guarantees. West Indies very nearly missed out on qualification. Afghanistan very nearly missed out on qualification. You almost had Scotland sort of making a run for it. Ireland came close as well. So the teams that are in danger most are probably West Indies and Sri Lanka.
Which is on West Indies, which is, they're currently playing Pakistan, and they lost a very close game yesterday. That series is huge because West Indies have played six of their eight series. They're currently playing their seventh. So realistically, they need probably at least two wins to have a chance in their remaining five games now, because they lost
quite
that game.
Possibly three. So they've got to win either a series against Pakistan away or New Zealand at home, which is in August, which is absolutely huge. Because New Zealand, so they have not played very many games. They've won six from six. So they've got another 18 games left to play, and they need to win
probably like five or six.
Five or six of those. So you know, they should be okay, but they've got work to do just because they haven't done much work so far. South Africa, another team who could potentially be in trouble, because they drew a series away to Ireland last year and lost at home to Bangladesh. Sri Lanka have also not had a great time, but there's another, what was the other really big series between Sri Lanka and Bangladesh? So Bangladesh are almost home dry, but if they were to lose 3-0 Sri Lanka, it becomes more of a question again. So it's been fascinating, but the issue that we've been discussing is that, I mean, even we have had to work quite hard to figure out whether or not it is fascinating. And you wouldn't know it from sort of watching the coverage of much of these games or from reading about it anywhere, and from the ICU who have not done a huge amount. I mean, you know, can you imagine in any other sport, if you have a fixture between two top teams that will be absolutely pivotal in determining which of those goes to the World Cup, and that not being like the headline when you're reading about it all the time, you know, like to know.
So this Pakistan series Pakistan winning that game puts them in a pretty good position, but it's a series that if West Indies had won that 3-0, Pakistan would be in serious trouble. And this is probably not going to happen because Ireland have got six wins from 18. But had Bangladesh and Afghanistan, probably like maybe 9th, 10th team in the world in a lot of people's eyes, had another one of those teams who you don't associate with qualifying for every World Cup, but they'd been doing really well, you'd be guaranteed to have a big team not making the World Cup because only two qualify from the qualifier. And there's just no attention, like, other than Ben on this podcast. No one's talking about it, really.
And he knows his stuff.
I mean, there are a few journalists who are very good at covering it, but it is only a few. The broadcast, you know, the IPL...
Do you think it needs the story of someone not qualifying in order to get the cut through?
It could well be that, you know, Sri Lanka, West Indies, South Africa all qualify for the World Cup because they qualify through the qualifier. But, you know, the IPL gets a lot of stick for how much it promotes itself when it's going on. The Premier League also just bangs on about how good the Premier League is. You need broadcasters saying all the time, like reminding viewers all the time, this is an absolutely huge game for West Indies' chances of qualifying to the World Cup. And that's not really happening. It's mentioned as an afterthought, but this is the whole point of these bilateral games. It's the tournament has given all these series context.
Who would be the biggest shock? Would it be if Pakistan might not qualify and West Indies might not qualify?
Pakistan should be fine.
But West Indies are in real danger.
West Indies, like, Sri Lanka and South Africa are in real danger of being in the qualifier, and they would still be favourites to qualify for the World Cup. But West Indies were the lack of DRS away from potentially not qualifying last time.
But South Africa, I think, will be the ones kicking themselves the most, because when you look through their team, I mean,
it's actually really good.
Yeah, and especially they've had this. I don't really understand how they've got themselves into the position, because they have players who have started astonishingly to their ODI careers, like Razib Anderson and Yanam and Milan are both averaging like over 70. There's a point when De Kock was like the worst member of that top five, and it's like, how have you managed to draw?
Well, they beat India in an ODI series that wasn't part of this ODI Super League recently. So I think they've lost against Sri Lanka away. didn't beat Ireland away. I think there's 1-1. One of the games is rained off. And I think they played one of their games against the Netherlands.
And that was cancelled as well.
That was a no result. Yeah. So,
but these things, I guess that's the sort of the beauty of it, is that these things can happen. It gives everyone a fair crack. You know, would it be like Italy not qualifying for a World Cup or Euros? I mean, these things happen in bigger sports like football, for example. So
yeah, but then they're cancelling the Super League. This is going to be the first and only edition of it. So
yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. That's possibly why there's not been as much promotion of it.
Yeah. Because how great this tournament is that we're not doing next time.
I mean, for example, like that Pakistan West Indies game yesterday was brilliant. Babar Azam scored 100. Shea Hope scored 100. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Shea Hope now has more ODI 100s than Viv Richards.
Again, it was quite low key.
I think it was more exciting because of the context. Like, you're interested. Well, hang on. Pakistan will probably qualify, but they're in a bit of trouble here if they don't win this series. And West Indies, you know, like they need to get these two or three wins from five difficult games remaining. And that context helps enjoy it, I think. So it's a shame.
It's just because broadcasters don't want to saddle themselves to, you know, no one wants to flog a dead duck sort of thing. It's because they don't want to be, although the cricket is interesting, it's like the nature of it will change, so they don't want to
possibly. But I think there's also, you have to ask questions of, I suppose, the ICC and their promotion as well, because this is kind of their tournament. And also, I mean, I was shocked to see actually just how much cricket is available on ICC TV for not very much money. Like it's kind of, I mean, I think it should be, I would fork out like a monthly thing.
Is it $8 a month or something like that?
Well, no, it's not. It's you pay per series at the moment.
Okay.
So that's why.
Which is a really good system.
you think it's better than...
Well,
should do that on Netflix.
It's a good option. I mean, I guess the other option is what we talked about on last week's show, of just having a flat out subscription for everything. But yeah, I mean, yeah, what's on it, basically?
Yeah, yeah. And like, so the current Sri Lanka-Australia series, I think you can pay $10 and get the whole tour. So that includes...
Five US dollars for the whole tour.
Okay, and that includes test match as well, so you get loads of great cricket in that. You can it's not much for the Pakistan West Indies tour that's going on at the moment.
$199 US.
But you know, you had a esteemed cricket journalist whose job it is kind of know about these things, like asking like how can I actually view this game? Is it just this kind of channel tucked away? I think it's Hum Masala tucked away on Sky. It's like, no, this is available on the global governing body's website, and yet somehow people who have, know, you know, millions of followers, tens of millions of followers across all platforms, and somehow they haven't shouted about enough so that people know about it. Something's going wrong there, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In other international cricket this week, Australia are 2-0 up in a T20I series against Sri Lanka, which you can watch on ICC TV, as we've just found out. There's big news from India this week. Mitali Raj has announced her retirement from the international game. She played for 23 years for India, making her international debut all the way back in 1999. She's the leading run scorer in the history of women's ODI cricket. She is one of just two teenage test match double centurions, the other being Javed Miandad. Ben, the word legend is overused in sport, but Raj is a genuine legend of not only India cricket, but world cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talked about the span, and it's not just the amount of time she played for. She was the bedrock of Indian batting, basically, from when she made her debut to this point now, which is a ridiculous span of time to be the key player in your team's batting line. I mean, you get players who play for that long, but I mean, there are lots of comparisons made between her and Sachin Tendulkar, but I think that they are fair, that's the touch point for that length of time to be doing that for. And she didn't just carry the team as well. It's not as if she was really good and India were okay. She made them a better team they've kind of been before, and she drove women's cricket forward in the country as well. I think
kept up with the professionalisation of the game as well. She was still brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that ODI record is ridiculous. I mean, she's the leading run scorer in women's ODI cricket by a massive distance. She's got nearly 8,000 runs. No one else even 6,000. She's averaging more than 50 in the format. She might possibly get caught by Meg Lanning as the leading run scorer, but Meg Lanning, you know, she's in her 30s now, so that she's only got just over 4,000, so she might not catch her, and then that record could just stand forever, basically. She's the only captain to lead India in two World Cup finals, and got so
men's
close.
Men's and women's, yeah.
Oh, got so close in that 2017 event, and I guess that could be the regret, that she never got a global title. But then when India do get one, and you think it will be when, especially, you know, with how much they're improving in T20 cricket, then there will be plenty of thanks paid to her. I think her, I couldn't figure this out, but her retirement message said she was retiring from international cricket. So I don't know if when the women's IPL launches, and it seems like it will launch next year, if she will be a part of that. But that would be a great way to sign off, if possible, for her, because she has been the cricketer who has been most responsible for making that possible.
Yeah, she also said she wants to stay in the game as well, so definitely not the last time we've seen her.
There was the famous clip of her reading poetry.
The Essential Rumi.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And it, that
during a World Cup. During a World Cup match, she was padded up waiting to bat in a World Cup game.
Do you think it was Rumi poetry, so the guest house. So I've got some lines here. So be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Do you think anyone in the England sort of test lineup would be doing a bit of Rumi poetry before they go into bat? Or
Who's most likely to be reading poetry?
Josh Butler was reading something, wasn't he? And Bairstow was reading something quite recently. I take quite a keen interest in what people are reading in dressing
rooms. When Rory Burns took up the Surrey captaincy, he read quite a lot of books on leadership sort of thing. I don't know if it's like Art of War or that sort of thing.
And Leadership for Dummies or something like that. That's not a comment on Rory Burns.
It's just like
I mean, that's the sort of thing I would do. Just crib with a, you know, yeah.
Going back to Rog, but also just a very aesthetically pleasing batter to watch. There are very few players in the women's game, men's game as well, who like were as fun to watch when she got going, yeah.
Yeah, and she had, you know, she was a forthright personality. Well, not that she was going out of her way to cause trouble. Everything she did, I think she did with a sense of purpose and principle, but because of that steadfastness in her own sense of self, she did at times butt heads. I mean, there was that during the 2018 World T20 was probably the most famous incident when she was dropped for the semi-final, and I think the coach pointed to her perceived slow scoring, and I think she maybe said she was unwilling to bat down the order. And then Mitali Raj, so it was leaked an email that she'd written to the coach and to Diana Adulji at the BCI, which was very eloquent and very scathing of the two of them.
This is good goss. I've not heard of
this.
Leaked, so she sent it saying, I'm not batting lower than three or whatever.
This was after the tournament. This was sort of like I felt the treatment was bad. That's not quoting, that's just the general tone of the thing. But it's well worth reading, because it gives an insight into sort of Raj's thinking, I think. That was an ugly incident, but I think it is revealing of a character who like wouldn't be cowed and who, you know, had to be that determined to have the career that she did, I think.
It's a great interview with her in the magazine, 2 years ago now, I think. That's well worth the read. But yeah, phenomenal career that's come to an end, international career at least.
I was just trying to think as well, so because she made her debut in 99 and she made her debut in Milton Keynes. And I was trying to work if it's been longer between her debut in Milton Keynes and now than between the founding of Milton Keynes as a city and her debut.
We're going to have to Google that now.
Do you think that's where she got into the poetry? It's not, I mean... Again, I'm not
sure. She could have got into
Milton
economics
Keynes.
There. It's like, who is Milton and Keynes?
Milton Keynes was founded in January 1967, so not quite. So it'd been 32 years between the founding of Milton Keynes and Raj's debut, and 23 years between Raj's debut and the present day. Moving on, the Charlotte Edwards Cup finals day is taking place this week. I quite like the structure of this tournament. You've got two groups of four, and you get a bonus point if you win with a run rate which is more than 1.25 of the team you beat. So a good chance to get bonus points. And the team with the most points across the two groups goes straight to the final. And the first game on finals day is basically a semi-final between the next two top scoring points teams. And the Vipers have won 6 out of 6. They're going straight into the final. Charlie Dean has done really well for them again when she's been fit enough to play. I spoke to her about her whirlwind 18 months that seen her go from someone without a pro contract to being an England regular who's represented her country in all three formats. Here is that chat with Dean. Charlie, it's great to have you on the show. First off, how's your season gone so far?
It's been a little up and down in terms of injuries. I missed two games of the Charlotte Edwards Cup because of a back spasm. But luckily, it was only minor and I've been able to come back into the team. And I think I've performed fairly well with the ball. I'm really happy with how I've been bowling, and the Vipers are such a great team to be involved with that they just make coming back into the squad really easy.
I mean, the Vipers have obviously got a good thing going. You won the Hey Ho Flint trophy last year in the final here. What do you put that continued success down to?
I think leading from the front, I think our head coach, Charlotte Edwards, is really, she says the right things. She's very inspirational with her words, and she really looks to bring the positive option out of us and sort of create fearless cricketers. And I think that's what she's done so well, is that as Vipers, we are able to go out there and sort of show our strengths and work well as a team because of the way that she goes about her coaching, I guess.
Going up playing the 100 last year and then playing, making your England debut, does having a coach like Charlotte Edwards really back you? Does that kind of make taking those steps up slightly easier in a way?
Yeah, definitely. I think when I went over to London Spirit for the 100, she was on WhatsApp, you know, often checking in, seeing how I was doing and saying well done. And I think having that kind of coach behind you is, makes you feel really confident in that when you go back to that team environment, it's seamless and inspirational, I guess.
You had an amazing rise over the last 18 months or so. You weren't one of the 40 contracted pros and now you're a regular in the England setup. What's that been like for you just on a personal level?
Yeah, I think it's been a whirlwind really. I think playing for England was something that I've always dreamed of, and I don't think this time last year I could have predicted the year that I've had. So yeah, it's been really special and hopefully I can sort of capitalise on that success and with the Vipers and in the 100 and moving forward as an England player.
Looking ahead later this year, if the big new shiny thing in the women's game last year was 100, this year it's the Commonwealth Games. Is that something you've thought about at all? Is it like a chance to get into the public consciousness in a way that maybe English cricket hasn't been able to as much in the last few years?
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for us, not only as a team to show what we can do, but I guess on that bigger stage in front of more eyes watching and hopefully inspire some more girls to play cricket. And I think it's going to be a really exciting opportunity to play a sport that we love and in front of getting that recognition that it deserves, I guess.
And then on your own bowling, have you always been an off spinner, or is that something that's developed relatively recently?
I think when I was younger, probably about 10, I was really short and a little skiddy seamer. But as, when I was 12, I think, I sort of developed I started out as a leg spinner, actually, but realised that was quite hard. And so off spin it was. But it's been something that I've not really focused on too much. I was mainly a batter throughout sort of my age group cricket. So it's definitely something that's been a more of a recent development in terms of like specialising in it, yeah.
When was it that you made that switch where you became predominantly an offie?
I think when I was 14, I had my first one-on-one like off-spin coach in Sam Lavery, who worked at my school. And that kind of sparked a bit of joy for it. And then I got into sort of the England Academy setups and there was that realisation that potentially there would be some off spinners spots opening up in, you know, the next few years as Lauren Marsh and Danny Hazel were going towards the end of their career. So I think then that was something that I saw an opportunity to really develop my skills and luckily it's paid off, I guess.
Absolutely. And then also on your style, you really give it a rip and you get a lot of turn. Do you have any spin bowling idols that you've looked up to over the years?
I think Graham Swan initially was kind of the off spinner that was playing in all the test matches when I was growing up. I think more recently Nathan Lyon is someone that I look at his bowling action and I almost want to replicate what he does.
And you're quite an attacking bowler as well. You take lots of wickets. Do you see your role primarily as a wicket taker rather than just a container?
I think initially I want to create as many dots as possible. And I think then that's when the wickets do come. I think because I've, as an off spinner, a lot of batters can kind of underestimate you, especially right-handers, as, you know, you pose less threat turning the ball into the pads. And I think I've probably capitalised on people potentially being a bit more attacking towards me as a newer player and ended up picking up some wickets. I think as a bowler, whenever you get a wicket, that's something that you're always looking to do. And I think I'd want to be known as that kind of attacking off spinner as opposed to going for a defensive option. Yeah.
A bit of nonsense to cover from elsewhere. In the Ranji Trophy, Bengal became the first class team to have 9 people score half centuries in the same innings. They only used 9 batters as they piled on 773 for 7 in their first innings. And in a Sri Lankan domestic T20 game, there was a tied 6-over game that saw both teams score 30 for 9. So there were 18 wickets that fell across the 72 balls that were bowled in the game. That game was between Gaul CC and Kalutara Town Club.
Did you see the other record from today as well?
Mumbai
set the record for the biggest ever margin of victory in a first class game.
Oh, wow.
They beat, they won by 725 runs in there. I think one of the things I love about these Ranji Trophy games is because they can be decided by first innings lead is the teams, I mean, love is used loosely. I wouldn't like this to come into all cricket. Teams have often very little incentive to not bat again and pile on loads more runs. So Mumbai made 647, bowled out Uttarakhand, I think, for 114, and then batted again and put up 261 and then bowled out for 69. So that was a reasonably one-sided game of cricket.
Imagine coming out to bat and you need 795 to win. Jim, you recently produced the Night Watchman podcast. What is it? What was it? Give us the history.
What is it? So the Night Watchman is Wisden's quarterly. It's a long-form magazine about cricket writing and sort of flights of fancy, and it's sort of ruminative and thoughtful, and it takes on a lot of new writers and established writers, and you can... there's no word count, so you can sort of go to town on pieces. So it's a fantastic publication, and we've just launched a podcast which is similar in a way in that it's different from other, maybe this show for example, or other cricketing podcasts, in that it's episodic and each episode takes a theme. And we explore those themes.
They're totally timeless.
Pull them apart. Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. So you can download them whenever you want. You can go to them, and they'll still be in date. And they took us a long time to do. So you might hear some sort of some references to lockdown 1 and lockdown 2, and maybe lockdown 3 as well. But I should say that they are written and hosted by John Hotton, who those of us in the know is one of the finest cricket scribes out there, and. Has a lovely soothing voice as well. I've listened to a lot of it because I put it together and edited it. So in my flat, me and my girlfriend have been listening to a lot of John Hotton. We feel like, I think she feels like she has met him, but you know, she... we've had some great guests. So the first series is all up now, and we've got the likes of Michael Atherton, Gideon Haigh, people within cricket, Mike Brearley, you know, biggest sap, but then also being a Night Watchman podcast, there are people who... slightly sort of what's the word,
and they're not established people within the game, they're famous.
Yeah,
they've done,
so we've got
it.
Yeah, Rampakash. I realize I'm just listing very established cricketers, but we've got the likes of Tom Holland, the historian, Tim Key, the comedian and poet. Who else do we have on there? We've got an episode about one thing to note is each episode is around a particular theme. I don't know if I said that. So we've got Is Cricket Funny, which is sort of a comedy episode. The Mystery of Cricket, which is about the Doosra and in stats, and Jared Kimmer and Osman Samuddin talk about that. We've got Talking About Cricket, which is an episode about commentary.
And we're now talking about that.
Talking about cricket, yeah. With Dan Norcross and Izzy Westbury. So yeah, there's some really great guests, and it was a lot of fun to do, and we're just this afternoon going to meet about doing a series 2 too.
Brilliant. Here's a snippet of Tim Key reading a poem about Mark Rampakash that's from the Night Watchman podcast.
Thank you. So this is called Ramps. This is a poem where I guess lockdown meets, well, ramps. Some new rules came in on the wages side of things. Now companies would pay 1/4 of your pay, the government would stump up 1/4, and Mark Rampakash would make up the rest. Ramps phoned up his agent immediately. Why am I paying half of everyone's wages over here? He was basically having a meltdown. This doesn't make any sense. How am I going to afford this even? Damn it! Why is it down to me suddenly? His agent was as calm as always. We're on to it, Mark. We think it's a mistake. Just stay calm, mate. We're going to send some emails. Ramps was whacking the phone against his cricket helmet. We're pretty sure they're going to row back from this, his agent went on. Ramps has sat on his kit bag now, his mouth twisted with the stress of it all, sweat pouring onto his tap shoes. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, I think where I'd start with that is...
I don't like the idea of you saying where you'd start with it. If you are you going to are you going to tear it apart?
Yeah. Well, no. I just wonder what part of your subconscious Mark Ramprakash was occupying during lockdown.
This is that's such a good question. Finally, someone who's asking a decent question. I think we can try and get to the bottom of why Mark Ramprakash is in that poem. Even just reading it out, I sort of sensed what was going on there. I mean, first things first, it's apparently quite arbitrary, and that could just be anyone. I mean, I suppose that could be, you know, Andy Crane or something. It doesn't need to be even from the world of cricket, but yeah. It does. It felt to me like Ramprakash was quite a good person to get into that kind of vehicle.
Yeah,
I mean, he'd
be the sort of person singled out by the government. In
yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's something very clean cut about him. Yeah. There's also something quite. He offers quite a lot, doesn't he? Because he's not in the centre of everyone's thoughts, but he's somewhere quite interesting because there's a lot of people who like him a lot, and then there's a lot of people who like him from a completely different world that he's appeared in.
Yes.
And so in a poem, it's quite nice to be able to have to just throw a cricket bat in and sling some tap shoes in at the end.
Tap shoes, yeah, right at the end, which was in many ways the killer payoff.
To finish the show, we've got a question from Diran. He asks, if you could take 5 wickets every time you play, but every game you play in, you lose, would you take it, Jim?
I mean, my bowling days are very much... So I probably would do, yeah, because that would be such a sort of strange thing to happen. I don't know. What's the old thing they say about cricket being an individual sport, a team sport played by individuals? I don't know if this is true, but I saw something on the train this morning of Jimmy Anderson being asked a similar thing.
Yeah, so
and it was on his
Lord's
board.
TikTok. It's the Lord's TikTok.
Oh, okay,
account.
It was. So it was an official thing, right?
And he was asked, would you rather be on the honours board or your team wins? I think that was the question. And he said honours board.
And he went honours board. Yeah. And obviously he's joking, but there's probably a nugget of truth in it. I guess you're the bowler, so we should ask you.
Funny you ask, because I took 3 wickets in a loss this weekend. But I'm only mentioning that on the pod because my first wicket was a caught behind that on reflection was probably not out, but the batsman came up to me later in the day. It turns out he listens to the pod. So Hampton Hill Cricket Club's Harry, I'm sorry.
And he walked.
He didn't walk. No,
he was overawed by your celebrity that he walked away.
No, the umpire
the
gave it out. I appealed.
Oh, okay.
And the umpire gave it
but
out.
You knew it wasn't out.
I didn't know it wasn't out.
Yeah.
I heard a sound. It went up.
Yeah.
Could have been anything.
Yeah. Could have been anything. Could have been anything. And I don't bowl with my glasses on as well, so I can't really see.
I do think that with this question, there must be a certain amount of monkey's paw effect. I mean, firstly, if you went into every game, it's fine to go
monkey's,
into a game.
Monkey's paw.
Yes. Well, yeah. But
so just explain what a monkey's paw is.
Well, I'll come to it. I think, first of all...
This is supposed to be the fun question at the end that
this,
we just answer quickly and then
is,
end
this
the
is
show.
Fun, I think. If you go, it ruins
monkey's
the,
paw.
It ruins the fun of a game if you go into it knowing you're going to lose and knowing you're going to take 5 wickets. Like, everyone loves not knowing if they're amazing.
We're getting back onto retirement
to...
chat, aren't we? We're getting back into the sort of...
But also, I think the monkey's paw thing would be, you know, your wickets would all be sort of like caught in the deep in the last over when they've already racked up 350 or whatever. And then obviously you lose by loads. So I think you'd have to not tempt fate and go with...
Got to go for the win. You'd much prefer your team to win. Absolutely.
To bring it back, I mean, because I don't bowl, so I might as well talk about myself batting. And I've not done a great deal of that all very well for a few years. But
well, Jim's supposed to have played for my club multiple times
it
and
will
he's yet
happen.
To play.
August is looking dreamy. I'm getting married, but apart from that, August is fine.
Apart from that, it's looking great.
Yes, it's looking really free. I've scored runs in games where we've lost and it doesn't feel quite as nice. So although you take the
well,
individual
the great cricketer
plaudits,
guys are probably, if they're listening to this, they'll be like, the best thing in the game is scoring 100 in a losing cause.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, cricket's such a weird thing, isn't it? Because you do have I've certainly got out on a road and watched my friends and teammates score loads of runs, and that's a pretty bleak feeling, actually, looking on and knowing that you've bagged a duck and someone else is going to get a ton. Pretty horrible. You know, someone like Phil will come in and tell you that he got a century at the weekend, and if you're going through a bad trot, then, or you're not playing, for example, then Yeah, that's a bad thing
about
cricket.
About something like that.
No. I was thinking about him when you were talking about Mitali Raj's email and thinking maybe that's the sort of thing he might do, but he's not here to defend himself, is he?
I think on that note, let's end the show. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Jim. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back after the Trent Bridge test.
Podcast Network.